Welcome to the Science Podcast for June 7th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, a special section on morphogenesis, regional climate patterns in the tropical Pacific, and the mysteries of development.
So we know that your environment in the womb is important, but we don't know exactly what those environmental triggers are and how they change the fetus in some manner.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Up until the early 1960s, it was thought that cells would divide indefinitely in a dish. In 1961, Hayflick showed that in the lab, normal human cells have a lifespan. They divide a certain number of times and then give up the ghost. But the Hayflick rule doesn't apply to stem cells. Not only can some stem cells divide indefinitely in culture, but under the right conditions, they can differentiate and start taking on the functions and forms of different organs. I spoke with Hans Clavers about the potential this type of cell culture has for studying development and curing disease.
My lab studies the lining of the gut. These cells are self-renewing every 4 to 5 days. This process is driven by very active stem cells. We discovered those stem cells a number of years ago and then learned how to culture them in a petri dish.
As you say, the intestinal lining is undergoing constant renewal. Can you describe how these cells are renewed, how they start and how they travel?
And when we look at the insides of the gut, we see crypts and villi. And the villi are protrusions into the lumen of the gut. They actually digest the food and they process nutrients into our body. Flanking these villi are the so-called crypts. These are little indentations where all the proliferative cells sit. They're safe from the contents of the gut. And that's also where the stem cells reside. And that's where new cells are being produced. They travel out of the crypts, up the flanks of the villi. And then about 4 or 5 days after they're born, they die at the tips of the villi and are shed into the lumen of the gut and digested like the food.
And you're able to grow these cells for extended periods of time in the lab, over a year, I think you said, in your paper. What is it about these cells or the lab techniques that permits this extended growth?
Yeah, when we tried to grow these cells, the general belief was that primary healthy cells from an adult human or mouse could not grow in a petri dish for more than a few days or a few weeks. However, our stem cells are extremely active. They divide every day, and they do this for 2 to 3 years in the body of a mouse. So we believe that we should be able to mimic the environment of the mouse gut in the petri dish. And we were very lucky to pick the exact right growth factors. And really, the magical component is a small protein called R-spondin. And R-spondin turns out to be a fantastic growth factor for many different types of stem cells. So that really makes the difference.
In the petri dish, you actually call the cell system an organoid. What is an organoid, and how similar are they to actual organs?
Now, when we start growing tissue from a single gut stem cell, these stem cells immediately make a little vesicle, what we call a cyst, and this vesicle will grow in size. The central lumen will be much like the lumen of the normal gut, and then we see protrusions sticking out of the central lumen, and they look very much like the crypts of a normal gut. I should stress that we call them mini-guts or organoids, but they only contain the epithelium of the gut. They do not contain muscle or blood vessels or lymph vessels or other tissues. But the epithelium of the gut is really the special tissue that allows us to digest food and to take it up into our body. So in that sense, it's a mini version of the normal gut.
Okay. So how does this system develop from a single cell into something that has surfaces and different kinds of cells?
Yeah, that's a magical situation that we don't really understand very much yet. What we see is that a single stem cell makes this little vesicle in a totally self-organizing way. The insides of the cells point to the inside of the vesicle, much like in the gut. The outsides, or the apical phase, points to the outside. We do have some molecular clues on how this works, but we are far from understanding the system. We can only conclude that these cells are amazingly self-organizing.
Can you outline a few of the uses these mini-guts might have as experimental tools?
Yeah, the mini-guts, because they resemble extremely closely the normal gut in a mouse or a human being, they can be used to study many different processes that you would normally study in a mouse or in a human. like digestion of food, like the interaction with microbes or pathogens, like the interaction with the immune system. And rather than having to kill a mouse or use very complicated invasive methods, we can just do these experiments on a microscope and do it in real time.
Mm-hmm. How about using a mini gut like this for treating disease? How would that work?
There is a paper that was published by a Japanese group together with us, Mamoru Watanabe's group. What we did with them is we grew from a single stem cell from a mouse gut, from a Dutch mouse, about 10 to the 8 cells. We sent them to Tokyo. There they were transplanted into the guts of about 40 mice that had ulcers in their colon, in their gut, a disease called colitis. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that, again, in a totally autonomous way, these mini guts find their way to the lesions of the colon. They'll settle there, and like a living Band-Aid, they will seal the lesion and they will help cure the mouse.
So I'm going to ask you to speculate a little bit further here. What other ways could this kind of cell culture system help with disease or experimentation?
Yeah, so we think that this method that works very well in mice will work in humans. Mm-hmm. There are not so many diseases one would like to treat of the intestine with stem cells. However, we've also published recently that the same trick can be applied to the liver. And there we have about 300 million people in the world with a failing liver who would benefit potentially from a transplantation. Again, we can grow a single stem cell into a lot of tissue, in this case liver tissue, and transplant it into sick mice and help them cure them. So that would be one application, but that's long term. In the short term, we have been using these organoids as disease models, and that's also extremely promising. We can grow organoids from little kids with cystic fibrosis and show that the channel is defective and actually show which experimental drugs help correct the problem with the cystic fibrosis channel. We are growing large collections of cancers, colon cancers. Turns out that every patient has an individual version that's slightly different from other patients, and we can now directly test on tissue from an individual patient what would be a good drug combination for that patient to be treated with.
Oh, amazing. All right. Well, Hans Clevers, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks very much for talking.
Hans Clevers is the author of a review in this week's special issue on morphogenesis at www.sciencemag.org/special/morph. That's M-O-R-P-H. You can read Clevers' review, a review on epithelial mechanics, and another on imaging during development that includes many videos and images. In addition to the reviews, you can also read a Science Careers article.
Hey, podcast listeners, this week's show is sponsored by Audible, and right now they're offering you a special deal. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And if you're looking for any ideas, I can recommend Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World by Sam Summers. It's about the mutability of human personality and the influence of context on behavior.
All right, check out that book and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. Every multicellular organism, each with its own complex set of organs, sensors, and functions, begins life as only one cell. While we've made great strides in understanding how organisms develop, we still don't know the signals and triggers for each step of the way. Deputy News Editor John Travis spoke with me about this week's special news section on the mysteries of development. I began by asking him how organisms know when to stop growing.
Yeah, that's a fascinating one. If you look around at nature, you see species that are small. You see ones that are huge. What determines that during development?
Right.
And that's something scientists really still don't understand. In our package, we note some experiments dating back to the 20s where they started to realize this was an interesting issue. One experiment, some scientists took embryonic tissue from a salamander species that was very large and transplanted it into a salamander species that is much smaller and did the opposite experiment. And they realized when the salamanders went through embryogenesis and the larvae grew up and they became adults that the small salamander ended up with a large leg, as if the leg that was transplanted knew it needed to be large. And the large salamander ended up with a small leg. So they knew that there was something intrinsic to the tissue that determined its size.
Right.
But only recently have they started to figure out some of the genes and molecules involved. One is called HIPPO, and that was discovered in fruit flies because when it's mutated, you get this overgrowth, and the skin of the fruit fly, as I recall, resembles a hippopotamus. If you mutate HIPPO, you get these problems in size control. But we still don't really understand how HIPPO itself works. So scientists are trying to piece together that pathway. And there are many other factors that go into size control. A lot of scientists think that mechanical forces, how cells are being stretched and pulled, ultimately determines whether a heart has reached the correct size. But it's a fundamental question that still has a long way to go.
Right. And the next mystery deals with the fact that we don't even really know how important the fetal environment is to the organism's development and its eventual health.
Indeed, one of the stories in this package doesn't really address development during embryogenesis as much as our health later in life. But we look at it through the perspective of how the fetal environment dictates your future health. And this is something that hadn't been appreciated until a researcher named David Barker started looking at birth and death records and realized that people who were born at a low birth weight had different rates of disease than people who had a normal birth weight. And that led to a whole field that at one point was called fetal origins of adult diseases, the idea being that the environment an embryo or fetus faces in the womb somehow influences if you're going to have heart disease when you grow up. And this has now been well established. It was resisted for a while, but other researchers have confirmed Barker's results. And now the interesting question is, what is the mechanism? How does the fetal environment shape your health? And there, we don't really know. Could be the hormones that come from a well-fed mother, or if you're a malnourished mother, somehow influence cell division or where the cells go in the embryo. So we know that this happens, that your environment in the womb is important, but we don't know exactly what those environmental triggers are and how they change the fetus in some manner.
All right. And now let's turn to the brain, the focus of one of the other articles. What are we now learning about the early development of the brain?
Well, the mystery we focused on for the brain was one that was a bit surprising to me in that you think of development as a finely honed process in which there's no place for error. And yet in the brain, we lose about 40 to 50% of the neurons that we create during development. They are essentially made for no apparent reason, or they're made and then discarded for some reason that we don't yet understand. This has been well documented, and there was a very popular hypothesis for why the brain made more cells than it ended up needing. It was called the neurotrophic hypothesis, and this was an idea that there was a chemical substance, a neurotrophic factor, and there wasn't enough of it made in the brain. So only the cells that were able to reach it or respond to it survived, and the rest committed suicide. We now know that the neurotrophic hypothesis doesn't explain all the cell death that goes on in the developing brain. And so scientists are trying to figure out what other reasons explain it. And this has become more important lately because we now know that neurons are born in the adult brain. This used to be heresy. No one thought that new neurons were born as an adult. But in a few places of the brain, that does happen. And again, we find out that of the cells that are born, only a few of them actually survive. So why does that happen? Is it the same reason as in the fetal brain? Perhaps. Is there a way we can influence that so that more cells survive in the adult? And would that actually help in diseases such as Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative diseases? These are all questions we don't have answers for, and that's why we picked it as a mystery.
And then there's that family of organisms that we've been learning so much about in just the past couple of years, and that's the microbiome. Do these microorganisms play any sort of important role during development?
Yeah, this was perhaps my favorite mystery in that it was one we didn't know about until recently.
Mm-hmm.
The microbiome are all the bacteria, fungi, and viruses that inhabit your body. And we're realizing that they do influence development because they've co-evolved with animals and plants throughout the millennia. And one way that scientists have begun to study this is by working with germ-free mice. These are mice that have been bred in sterilized colonies and they eat sterilized food. And so they don't acquire bacteria when they're born, like mm-hmm. most of us do. And these animals have problems in the development of their intestinal system, of their immune system. And most provocatively, evidence suggests that their brains don't develop quite the same way. Now, the twist at the end of this mystery was that a human baby in a womb is thought to live in a sterilized environment. There are no microbes. And so the microbiome probably doesn't influence your development until after birth.
Hmm.
At least that's what was thought. But we now know that microbes secrete products into the bloodstream of a mother, and those might make it into the fetus.
Hmm.
So there's a whole new potential area, which is microbial influence on the fetus. And we don't even have evidence to talk about at that point, which makes it a good mystery.
Yeah, very cool. So, of course, the closer that we get to solving these puzzles, the more questions pop up. So what are some of the newer, more lingering mysteries that really have yet to be tackled?
There are way too many mysteries for us to cover in this
right.
package. And we try to tease with a few other ones that are out there. One we didn't cover in great detail, but the writers thought was very interesting, is the whole issue of identical twins and why they differ if they had the same genes and same fetal environment. What that points out is that there is an element of chance to development, and we don't know how much of development is influenced by chance. But that's something that scientists are trying to figure out as they compare twins genetically and at some point their fetal environment. Another one that scientists are trying to figure out is related to stem cells, a very hot field. Stem cells can replicate indefinitely, but at a certain point, they can also start to differentiate and become an organ or a tissue. When do they know to pick that latter path
mm-hmm.
versus dividing forever? That signal or signals is still unclear. The tools are getting better to study development. New microscopes can follow cells in a fetus. Some of this is talked about in the special issue on morphogenesis that is also in this issue. But I think we're going to need new research techniques and tools to even broach some of these mysteries.
Okay. Well, John Travis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Travis edited this week's special section on the mysteries of development. You can find all the related news articles online at www.sciencemag.org/special/DEVO2013.
Last week, our policy podcast featured outgoing editor-in-chief Bruce Alberts. This week, our new editor-in-chief, Marcia McNutt, sat down with Meghna Sachdev to discuss the changing of the guard at Science. Here's an excerpt of their interview.
The chance to steer this journal through the 21st century is an opportunity I could not say no to.
You can listen to the whole interview and read Marcia's editorial at www.sciencemag.org.
The Earth's climate system is vastly complicated. Things like temperature and rainfall are dictated by the atmosphere and hydrosphere, which are in turn driven by climate forcings. Things like pollution, solar radiation, and the greenhouse effect, which can all lead to major shifts in climate. How the overall climate system has responded over time to such forcings is well documented, but behaviors on a regional scale are harder to track down. Now, using isotope levels recorded in stalagmites, Stacy Carolyn and colleagues have interpreted the rainfall patterns over part of the tropical Pacific during the last 100,000 years, and they found more variation from the global average than they expected. Carolyn spoke with me about her findings.
Our paper presents a record of hydrologic variability in the western tropical Pacific, which was created from analysis of four collected Borneo stalagmites that formed over most of Earth's last glacial period. The record suggests that western tropical Pacific hydroclimate had a variable response to different climate forcings. For example, glacial conditions and significant abrupt climate events captured in the Greenland Ice Core apparently had a very small impact on regional hydrology than either solar radiation or a handful of millennial scale events evident in North Atlantic Ocean sediment records.
Okay, so this was basically all about regional climate. You were interested in how this one particular area of the Western Pacific responded, interacted with global climate changes happening within the last 100,000 years or so.
Yes, that is correct. We chose our study site because there's actually not a lot of records from the Western Tropical Pacific, and that site today has a significant impact on atmospheric circulation and convection. So we really want to understand how it was responding to forcings in climate in the past, which will better equip us to predict what's going to happen in that area into the future.
So you collected stalagmites in Borneo. Can you tell me about the experience of working in that kind of field area?
I am in absolute love of our field site. These samples were collected from this extraordinary karst system, which is hidden away in this beautiful rainforest at Gunung Mulu National Park on Borneo Island. Our site is a World Heritage Site. And when we go, I've been there three times now, our group stays at our research center in park headquarters. And each morning we wake up and we head out to these cave entrances. And then we follow our irreplaceable local park guides, who have now become very close friends with myself and other students, about an hour-long hike through these vast cave chambers. It's kind of like rock climbing in the dark in order to reach these beautifully decorated caverns. And I really want to stress that our most important goal as visiting scientists is to respect nature's beauty. So we take great care not to damage any formations, and we only target broken stalagmites that have already fallen on the cave floor or collecting drip waters and pool waters. And these formations have formed over hundreds of thousands of years.
Wow.
And it's just very impressive, and I feel very fortunate to be in their presence.
So you're looking at the climate records from the last glacial period, so that's around the last 100,000 years or so. From other isotopic records around the world, we know quite a bit about what's happened to the global climate during that period. So what are some of the big events, the big climate changes that you would be looking for in isotopic records?
First, I just think it's important to dissect and explain what we know about average global climate variability versus what we know about a specific region's climate variability during this glacial period. So on a global average scale, we do understand how global atmospheric CO2 and global temperature varied over the last glacial cycle, which also fall hand in hand with global ice volume, the planetary albedo, and sea level shifts, in addition to solar radiation forcing. And all that we've learned from long ice core records collected in Antarctica and ocean sediment cores, which can span over hundreds of thousands of years. Next, if we want to get higher resolution, we go look at individual regions. And at these places, we see evidence in many paleoclimate sites of certain abrupt millennial shifts in either temperature or hydrology. And so based on where we see these events and if any relations exist, we then as scientists work to propose a specific mechanism that can explain how these events are connected and being forced by different climate variables. So again, our site is significant because there are not yet many records from this region that span the last glacial cycle with such resolution and such a robust age model that we are able to produce. So we're kind of adding to the team effort to make all these records in different areas of the globe and come up with a mechanism to explain what is going on when Earth is in this glacial state.
So what did you find at this high resolution? How did the hydrology of this particular region reflect the global changes that you knew were occurring?
Well, what I do is I take these stalagmites back to the lab. I cut them open with a giant rotary saw, and then I take samples down core at a 1 millimeter scale, and I measure the oxygen isotope inside that calcite, and we relate that to rainfall amount. So what I found in these records is that on glacial interglacial scales, variables such as global temperature and atmospheric CO2 did not drive significant changes in rainfall at our site. Large chunks of the record did vary in phase with equatorial solar radiation cycles, which is energy from the sun. Regarding more abrupt millennial scale events, we see 6 decreases in rainfall at our site that correspond with events captured in North Atlantic Ocean sediment records. However, we don't see correspondence to the many abrupt shifts in temperature recorded in the Greenland ice core record. And then finally, the largest millennial scale shift is actually occurring at 73,000 years ago, which is something that did not stand out in these Northern Atlantic records. And this happens to be coincident with the Toba volcanic super eruption, which took place on the island of Sumatra, which is in Indonesia, right west of our site. It's a huge eruption, the largest in the past 2.5 million years. So it's just very interesting that it occurred at the same time that our site shifted abruptly towards dry conditions, which lasted over 1,000 years.
Wow.
Yeah, very interesting, because just volcano eruptions do not affect climate for that long of a scale. It might have just been a coincidence, and if these two events are related is a question we'd like to answer in the future.
Okay, so you found that the hydrology of the Western Pacific here was really quite variable, or the response of the hydrology was really quite variable to other climate forcings, especially compared to other regional climates elsewhere. So was this surprising to you?
Yeah, what you just mentioned was one of the most surprising, in that whereas other climate records, so specifically one of the most famous is these Chinese stalagmite records, because they're very well dated, very high resolution, very nice records that show these abrupt climate shifts that are also seen in Greenland, it became a question of, are these mechanisms affecting sites on a global scale? And right now, all we have is these Chinese records that are occurring at about 30 degrees north latitude. We also see that signature in the Atlantic sector of Antarctica. And so the way to explain these events is there's a forcing that happens in the North Atlantic that weakens the ocean circulation belt and shifts the convection zone that's over the tropics south to make the northern hemisphere both cooler and drier. The problem is that in our record, we do see this occurring during certain events, but we don't see it occurring on other abrupt events. So either this mechanism is not affecting us for some reason, or there are two mechanisms to explain two types of abrupt climate change events. Our site is possibly influenced by several different forcings, and sometimes if you're influenced by one in a positive direction and one in a negative direction, the net effect can kind of skew how that is affecting you. So one of our suggestions on why we see one but not another of these abrupt climate shifts is just that these mechanisms are somehow different, but we don't have an answer yet for what is going on in these other events. We don't really know why they're not affecting us. We'd like to investigate further.
So what can all of this tell us about what's happening with climate today? Is there anything that we can sort of extrapolate from all of this?
That's a common question. I consider myself a historian, so I look into the past, and the question is, well, why do you do that? How can that help us to better see into the future?
Right.
And one important part of paleoclimate is that it can be used as a testbed for climate models. For example, scientists are beginning to test their climate prediction models on various climate forcings in the past, such as CO2 changes, global temperature changes, solar radiation, perhaps volcanic eruptions, these abrupt climate events. And so when you put in all these forcings, you want to see how your model climate responds. So because the last glacial period is so incredibly rich with these forcings, we have all of these taking place our record provides an excellent test for these models to determine whether the model results match what our tropical Pacific data is suggesting actually happened. And then once you do that, you can feel more confident in using this model to predict future climate changes.
Great. Well, Stacy Carolyn, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much.
Stacy Carolyn and colleagues write about regional climate patterns in a Science Express report this week. You can find it online at scienceexpress.org.
Finally today, Lizzie Wade, a writer for our online daily news site, is here to give us a rundown of some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the tiniest primates ever discovered. Under a lake bed in China, researchers discovered a tiny, ancient, fossilized primate, and after 10 years of study, we're starting to get some answers.
Yeah, so this fossil is known as Archosaurus achilles, and the achilles part comes from the fact that its foot is pretty special. It looks a lot like a monkey foot, even though this thing lived well before monkeys ever evolved. It's 55 million years old. And it falls right at this point on the primate family tree where a group of primates called anthropoids, which include monkeys, apes, and eventually humans, are diverging from another group of primates known as tarsiers, which today live only on a few islands in Southeast Asia. Archosaurus is just slightly more tarsier than anthropoid, but it has a lot of anthropoid features like the monkey-like foot and these pretty small eyes that have helped researchers conclude that it probably hunted during the day and not at night like modern tarsiers.
Right, because modern tarsiers have giant
eyes. The researcher told me that a single tarsier eyeball has the same volume as a tarsier brain.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. What are we working with here? How much of the animal was actually recovered in these fossils?
It's quite well preserved, especially for something that is so tiny. They think the animal weighed less than an ounce, which is significantly smaller than any primate living today. So this thing is really small, and it was very hard to find. In fact, they couldn't really even extract it from the rock that it was embedded in. They had to take it to a synchrotron in France to use the x-rays there to image it. But once they did, they saw that they had quite a few bones preserved. The feet are really well preserved, as are the hind legs and all the vertebrae and this very long tail that it had. The arms are missing, and the skull is there, but unfortunately, it's partially crushed. So that's where everybody expects there to be the most debate about this fossil in the coming years. Like, what exactly does the skull look like when you reconstruct it?
So what does this tell us about the history of tarsiers and just, you know, primates in general?
Well, it tells us that our earliest primate ancestors were likely really, really small, which has been a debate for a long time in the field. And it tells us something really interesting about where primates originally evolved. Humans, as we know, evolved in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, scientists thought that all primates evolved in Africa, that everything happened there. And now, with this fossil and with a few decades of other fossils that have been found, that origin location has likely moved to Asia. So researchers are thinking that the very first primates evolved in Asia and moved to Africa and the rest of the world from there.
What else is going to be done with these fossils now that we have this first load of information?
Well, this first load of information took about 10 years to get. They discovered this fossil 10 years ago and have been keeping it very secret ever since. And so any other information that comes out will likely take a while, but they already have more synchrotron data that they just didn't have a chance to analyze for this first round. So they're going to keep looking, and of course they're going to keep excavating. That's what's really going to help, is if they could find other similar fossils of its close relatives, right? So you could tell more about its precise position on the primate family tree if you knew the other kinds of animals that were right around it. They were pretty lucky to find this really remarkable specimen, so it's going to be hard to find anything else like it, but they are trying.
Next up, we have a story on love and marriage in the internet era. Internet dating has become commonplace, but how do these relationships hold up in the long run?
Pretty well, science suggests. So at this point, it's been several years since these online dating sites have really come into their own. So researchers, social science researchers and psychologists are starting to be able to get real data on relationships that have started online and have lasted or not.
This is a pretty big data set. I think it's 20,000 couples.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
A scientist who is actually an advisor to eHarmony, which is a big dating website, had realized that they probably wanted to do a survey of how exactly online dating is affecting people's relationships or contributing to them. So he convinced eHarmony to pay for an online survey, which he then had analyzed by independent researchers, and eHarmony had agreed to publish this information no matter what the results were. Mm-hmm. And so they sent out an email survey, appropriately, I suppose, to almost 500,000 people. 200,000 of those responded, and almost 20,000 people out of those were chosen to participate. Those 20,000 people who participated got married between 2005 and 2012.
So they studied couples that were married at a certain point in time. And how were these marriages different from those that were sparked offline?
Well, first of all, an impressive fact about online dating, I guess, is that it's really become quite mainstream. Over one-third of the people surveyed who got married in between 2005 and 2012 met their spouse online, and half of those people met on online dating, dedicated online dating websites. The rest of them met through chat rooms or video games, other places you can meet people online. The people who met online turned out to be slightly less likely to divorce and scored slightly higher on signs of marital satisfaction, like if they answered yes to questions like, do you still have chemistry with your partner? Things like that.
So there are some caveats for this research. Can you talk about those a little bit?
They did control for demographic information and, crucially, how much time you spend online. So they were trying to get a representative sample of the population in terms of online habits. They didn't really control for things like personality, mental illness, things like that. It's not necessarily the case that people who participate in online dating website have more or less incidence of these things, but it would help to know that.
And one way to get around this problem was suggested in the article.
One scientist suggested that one way of getting around some of these issues of having a representative sample of different kinds of people would be to randomly assign participants in a future study to meet people either online or in the real world. I guess this would have to be people who are interested in dating. And I'm not sure exactly how this would work, but it sounds interesting. Unfortunately, this researcher says that at this point, none of the online dating firms are interested in funding such research.
Okay. Finally, we have a story on the cicadas chirp. These noisy bugs are undergoing a boom in the U.S. right now. And while we know things about their life cycles that allow us to predict booms like this, we don't know how cicadas make all the racket that they do.
Yeah, so cicadas are really loud, famously loud, as we are soon to discover on the East Coast, I'm sure. And scientists who study acousticians, are very interested in exactly how cicadas, who have tiny little bodies, they're bugs, how they can make such loud noises. So a couple of them have studied the anatomy of the cicadas. So the part of the cicada that helps them make the noise is called a timbal, and they have two of them, which are located on each side of the abdomen. It's kind of like a little drum where a membrane is stretched between two ribs, but instead of beating on the drum or beating on that membrane, the ribs themselves expand and contract really quickly, and that is the thing that creates the noise.
So how do they figure out how the noise was generated from these tiny bugs?
So to study, you know, those really, really small features of the cicada's anatomy, they used microcomputed tomography, which is a kind of CT scan, and it can pick up details as small as a micron in size, which is good because the ribs in the cicada's timbal are like about as big as a human hair. So they really had to get very deep in there to figure out what was going on.
We know these are loud, but what about by the numbers? What is the power of a cicada's chirp?
So the loudest cicadas can make a noise that's 20 to 40 decibels louder than any shelf speaker that you can buy in Radio Shack. So it's really loud. And they're so small, so that's really a shocker.
Right. And so they don't have a lot of energy or a lot of leverage, but they're making this giant noise. What mm-hmm. are some of the applications for this type of research then?
So in one field that you really want to know how to make loud noises without needing to use a lot of power is in sonar. And the Navy is really interested in using this for obvious reasons. That's how they image things underwater. And they think it would just be great to have a really powerful sonar machine that could run on as little power as a cicada needs.
Okay, well, what else is on the site this week, Lizzie?
We have some really great stuff. One of my favorites was a story about how guppies can father offspring from beyond the grave. Also on the site this week, we have a story about the ancient origins of French wine. That was fascinating and delicious sounding. And on Science Insider, our policy blog, we had a great story about Europe's new particle physics plan and its implications for the whole field. And coming up this week, we have a live chat about some of the challenges of getting humans to Mars, and we'll have a very special guest, Buzz Aldrin, the famed astronaut and second man on the moon. So please tune in to ask him any questions you have about the challenges and potentially the benefits of long-term human space travel. And next week, we have a chat about bioelectronics. These are all video chats, so you can watch and ask questions about our cyborg future.
Okay. Lizzie Wade is a writer for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the June 7th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.